Hello, everyone. I'm very excited to be here today. We've been sending our nurses to this conference for a long time. And Rick Paulson, one of my mentors and partners that I work with, has come here and lectured many times, and I've heard so many great things about this conference, so it's nice to finally be here. I've been set forth with a task this morning to talk to you about the challenges, strategies, and outcomes of dealing with women of advanced maternal age. And that's a broad topic. I think pretty much every lecture that you guys are going to have is going to touch upon this, with the exception of the last lecture. So I'm going to try my best to just really focus on the salient points and things that I think are really important in dealing with patients who have advanced maternal age and how we can best assist them in terms of helping them achieve their dreams of having a baby. And where is the advancer? Is it totally obvious? No, is it here? There we go. Here we go. So what I'm going to talk about today, I'm just going to focus on a few things. I'm going to talk about the effect of age on fertility. You heard a little bit about that this morning already. I'm going to talk and touch upon just briefly preserving fertility so that we can circumvent the impact of age on fertility, maximizing our ability to help these women who have advanced maternal age as they go through ART processes. And then lastly, talk about the outcomes and risks associated with getting women pregnant beyond the age of what we consider natural childbearing. So this graph here is a graph of marital fertility rates in natural populations. So this is actually looking at couples who aren't using any contraception and seeing what their rate of fertility is. On the x-axis, you see the age of the wife, and the y, you see the rate of pregnancy for 1,000 women. And as you know, after the age of 27, we start seeing the rates of fertility declining. That rate of decline speeds up as a woman gets older, especially in her late 30s, and especially after the age of 40, where you can see that the rate of fertility plummets. When you look at ART success rates, you see that same curve. This is from our CDC rates, and the blue is live birth, or pregnancy, excuse me, and orange is live birth. And you can see, even with IVF, we cannot solve the issue of age, and that as a woman gets older, we start seeing the rates of success with IVF go down slowly after the age of 27, in the mid-30s, and then plummeting really after the age of 40. If you look specifically at women in their 40s, and this is the ART success rates in women in over 40, broken up by age, looking at both pregnancy and live birth rates, what you can see with each year after the age of 40, pregnancy rates and live birth rates decrease by 3 to 5% each year. So why is it that embryos that come from women that are older, and obviously eggs that are older, why do they implant at a lower rate than younger eggs? Well, the answer is egg quality. But we know that as a woman ages, she's not just losing the quality of her eggs, she's losing the quantity of her eggs. And these are two very important facts that you have to understand. And in fact, the biological clock is kicking in before, as women, were even born, all right? For a woman, she has the most eggs in her ovaries. When her mother is 6 months pregnant with her, she's got 6 million eggs. By the time she's born, she's got 2 million. By the time she's 37, it's down to about 25,000. And when you go through menopause, around the age of 51, you have very few, less than 1,000. And what you can see up here on this slide is this is actually pictures of the ovary, and these are the follicles, the fluid-filled sacs that have the eggs in them, and you can see at birth, there's lots of follicles. As a woman gets older, that number of follicles goes down, and by the time they go through menopause, it's very, very low. The graph above is actually showing you the number of eggs that a woman has in her ovaries, and you can see that, the curvature of that line is exactly what we see in pregnancy rates, both in natural conception and with IVF. So why is that happening? I know you guys have heard a little bit about this already, but remember, with the egg, there's two really important components. The mitochondria of the egg are getting older. The mitochondria, as you may remember, these are the energy-producing organelles of the cell. They make the energy. Well, without energy, the egg can't do what it needs to do, even if the sperm gets in and fertilizes it. So you have an embryo, it's been fertilized. It has to divide, it has to travel down the fallopian tube, get into the uterus, implant. All those mechanistic functions of the egg do not function as well in an egg that's older. In addition to this, you also have the chromosomal issues. So the chromosomal content of the egg, and therefore the embryo, are much more likely to be abnormal. The egg, it's not mechanistically good enough in terms of kicking out all the extra chromosomes that it needs to. So you end up having an egg that has either too many copies of a chromosome or not enough copies of a chromosome. So when it gets joined with a sperm, it becomes an embryo with an abnormal complement of chromosomes. So that what we know is that with older eggs, we have embryos that have worse cell division, they have decreased implantation. This leads to our patients who are older not being able to get pregnant at the same rates as younger patients, and they also have higher rates of miscarriage. So if you look at miscarriage rates in comparison to fertility rates, that you can see as a woman's natural ability to conceive goes down, the chance that she's going to have a miscarriage also goes up. So even if she does get pregnant, she may miscarry. And in fact, if you look at the miscarriage rates in the CDC statistics, you can see that miscarriage rates go up, and they go up much more dramatically in the late 30s and 40s. Miscarriage rates are about 15% in women that are 35. By the time a woman is 40, it's 30%. By the time a woman is 45, the chance that she is going to miscarry if she gets pregnant is 50%. That's really high. When a woman gets pregnant, as she gets older, even if she doesn't miscarry, she's going to have to go through her first trimester screening. In that first trimester screening, we're looking for the risk of Down syndrome, the risk of other chromosomal abnormalities. And what you can see from this graph that exemplifies what those rates are is that essentially every 3 years, a woman's risk of having a chromosomal abnormality doubles. So from 37, the risk of any chromosomal abnormality is 1 in 83. By the time she's 40, it's 1 in 40. And by the time she's 43, the risk of having any chromosomal abnormality is 1 in 19. Another way to show you this data is to look at the results of what we see with PGD. I know you guys talked about PGD yesterday, which is pre-implantation genetic diagnosis. Now, most of the time, we're doing it with blastocysts on day 5. We're taking cells from the trophectoderm, and we're testing those cells and actually finding out what the complement of chromosomes are in that embryo. So these are data from PGD results of blastocysts. And what they're showing us is what is the percentage of patients that actually will have a normal embryo of the blastocyst that we're testing, all right, based on both their age and the number of blastocysts that we're seeing. And what we see is that as a woman gets older, her chance that she'll actually have a normal embryo in that small complement of blastocysts is much lower at above 42. It's 24% if she only has 1 to 3 blastocysts. Where if she's less than 35, it's about 85%. She is much more likely to have a normal embryo. So again, a lot of this is statistics. If you look at actually the embryos that you're testing and what percentage of them are normal, you can also see that age is taking a huge hit. For women that are under 35, they are having, of the embryos that we're testing, about 60% of them are going to be normal. Above the age 42, look at those numbers, they go down. Look at that last column, 14, 17, 16%. The number of embryos that the women have that are chromosomally normal are just lower. So again, a lot of our approach to these women is what can we do to optimize the number of eggs that we have? Fundamentally, we can't change the aging process, but what can we do to best help them get pregnant? And we'll talk about that a little bit later when we talk about stimulation protocols. One thing I do want to point out to you in this slide, and this will come up a little bit later in the talk, is look at the egg donors. Even in egg donors, when you test their blastocysts, they don't have 100% normal embryos. And this is important when you're talking to your patient. I think patients who go through IVF, they struggle for years, they've had 5 failed IVF cycles, they go to egg donor, they assume that egg donor is going to work the first time. Right? Shouldn't it work? This is a 20-year-old. And I think you have to set the expectation for them that although egg donation is really great and it's very successful, it is not perfect. And that's because not every embryo, even from an egg donor, is perfect. One of the interesting things that I think this slide will show you is that, again, just like what we talked about with the quality of the eggs, it's not all just chromosomes. Those mechanisms of the egg are also aging, and that plays into why an embryo implants or doesn't implant. So if you look at this graph, this is a study from 2012. They kind of broke up the women just under 35 and over 35, and they wanted to look at the delivery rates per embryo in these two age groups. So in the gray bars, you can see these are just all of the embryos, right? It doesn't matter. They don't know if they're euploid, meaning normal chromosomal complement, or aneuploid. And what you can see as a result of the woman's age is that her delivery rate is lower per embryo. When they did the testing and looked at blastocysts and found out that these blastocysts were normal chromosomes, so they have the normal chromosomal content, if you look at the pregnancy rates in women that are 35 or less than 35, they're still 50%. They're not perfect. So other things go into why an embryo implants besides chromosomes. Chromosomes are important, but they're not everything. And what you can see is that those other issues are a bigger problem in women when they're over the age of 35, because even when you have a euploid embryo, a normally chromosomed embryo, when over the age of 35, you see a big decrease in the pregnancy rates. So those issues, those of mitochondria, of the telomeres, of the chromosomes, mechanistic embryos, are a problem in women that are over 35. So is there a way to prevent the decline in aging? And my first answer is no. We can't prevent getting old. It's something we have to deal with all the time in other parts of our bodies in addition to just reproduction. But my second answer is, maybe it's yes. Maybe we can do something about it by doing egg freezing, not necessarily preventing the decline in aging, but maybe circumventing it. So we know that egg freezing can preserve egg quality, and I know you guys will have a talk on egg freezing later today. This is, again, another graph of looking at IVF pregnancy rates in women as they get older. As they get older, the pregnancy rates goes down. The concept of egg freezing is if you take an egg out at the age of 33, even though the woman gets older, and all of a sudden she finds herself at 43 and she's ready to have that baby, she can use those eggs that she froze when she was 33 years old, and her pregnancy rate remains the same. It remains that of which the age when she froze her eggs. Egg freezing is becoming much more popular in this country and worldwide. The first baby that was born after egg freezing was actually back in 1986. That's not much later than the first baby that was born after the first frozen embryo. Egg freezing has become much more popular, as you can see from this slide here. Back in 2007, we saw a huge push in egg freezing, and it's only grown since then. This is what's reported in the U.S., and in the U.S., obviously, as you know, we don't have a great reporting system for live birth. And people don't publish as much because they are all working at different academic centers and we don't have a centralized database. In Europe, especially in Italy, where in Italy, I don't know if you guys know, but they are only allowed to fertilize the number of eggs that they're planning to transfer because of religious reasons. So in Italy, the physicians and embryologists there have had to be very proactive about their egg freezing protocols, and so they were one of the very first people to actually push for this technology and push it getting better over the last decade or so. They've also been able to publish their data because they have more centralized databases. And if you look at this slide here, which is from the committee opinion that ASRM put out last year on fertility preservation, these are the only four randomized controlled trials looking at egg freezing that exist. I want you to turn your attention to the two in the center in 2000. Both of these were in 2010. These are randomized controlled trials of egg freezing, so comparing pregnancy rates, fertilization rates with those women that have their eggs frozen and those women that are going through fresh IVF cycles. And if you can see from these two studies, the COBOS study in 2010, which was done in egg donors, and the Ranzi study in 2010, which was just done in infertility patients, what you see is not only is the survival rate of eggs very good in the mid-90s, but fertilization rates are very similar between the fresh cycles and the egg freezing, about 74% in the COBO study in both groups and around 80% in the Ranzi study. If you look at the very bottom, you're going to see the clinical pregnancy rates. And in both of these studies, the clinical pregnancy rates are on par in both groups, meaning that the pregnancy rates from those women who froze their eggs versus the fresh cycles were very similar. There have been other studies in Italy that are more than just these. These are very highly skilled labs. They focus on this all the time, and people always ask the question, okay, these are the best people in the world at egg freezing. Can other people replicate that? And the data that's out there suggests that we're getting pretty close. We may not have the exact pregnancy rates that these groups do, but we're getting pretty close. And there's a lot of data that's come out of Italy. In the U.S., we don't have as many publications just because we don't have these large centralized databases, but we are seeing a lot of reports of very good success rates with egg freezing. This is from the committee opinion, and I think it's important as practitioners that we all are aware of what ASRM is putting out there in terms of what their beliefs are of the different treatments that we can offer our patients, and this is what was put out last year. So one of the things that they say is that they very much support the use of egg freezing in terms of helping those women who are having to go through chemotherapy. So people who are preserving their fertility for cancer reasons. They are going to have cancer, they need to go through chemotherapy, they want to freeze their eggs before they have to go through the chemotherapy treatment that is going to be very toxic to the eggs. And they're very supportive of that. However, they do have some concerns about the safety, efficacy, cost-effectiveness, and the emotional risk to the patients of patients going through egg freezing just for elective preservation. And so you do need to be aware of this. This is what your patients are hearing, reading on the internet. They do also caution us about marketing this technology to patients because what we want to do is we do want to help them preserve their fertility, but we don't want to give them false hope and encourage them to delay childbearing because they say, oh, I have 10 eggs in the bank. I don't have to get pregnant. I'm going to wait till I'm 48. That's not such a great idea. So it's our responsibility to educate our patients about what their true chances are of success with the eggs that they have frozen. And that's where this last line comes into play, and that we do have to counsel our patients very adequately. That being said, I think that there is enough data to suggest that egg freezing is a very successful technique and one that we are using more and more commonly in our own practice. And so therefore, with all the techniques that we have, is it ethical to at least not offer it to our patients who are asking about fertility preservation? So let's get back to the woman who has not frozen her eggs. She's 42 and is having a hard time getting pregnant. What can we find out about that patient that will best predict her success with ART? And the answer is markers of ovarian reserve. So we have some ability to figure out, okay, you're 43, you're not getting pregnant. What can I learn about you that will help me figure out not only what is the best treatment regimen for you, but with that treatment regimen, what is your chance of getting pregnant? So the main things that we use in daily practice are an ultrasound looking at antral follicle count, day 3 FSH and estradiol levels, and AMH levels. So what is your antral follicle count? The antral follicle count is the sum of the antral follicles that we see in both ovaries, and we like to do this at the beginning of the menstrual cycle when the cohort is the largest. When women have low antral follicle counts, we see that they have a poor response to ovarian stimulation and they're less likely to achieve a pregnancy. But what's a normal antral follicle count? And part of what you have to remember is if you think back to that slide where we were looking at the number of eggs that a woman has as she gets older, well, that number goes down. So we don't expect someone who's 41 to have the same antral follicle count as someone who's 32. So what is considered normal is going to change as a woman gets older. When she's younger, in her less than 40, maybe an antral follicle count of 12 is acceptable. Whereas she's over 40, it might be more typical for you to see only 6 antral follicles. Whereas what you might consider someone who's a poor responder is someone who's less than 40 has an antral follicle count of only 5. And when they're above 40, only 3. What about the day 3 FSH? So FSH stands for follicle-stimulating hormone. Remember, it's the hormone that the brain secretes to tell the ovary to make a follicle, make that egg, ovulate it, all right? Well, what happens with FSH is that when you have lots of eggs in the ovary, those eggs are making something called, they make a little estradiol, but they make something called inhibin. Inhibin feeds back on the brain, and it tells the brain not to make FSH. Right? So what ends up happening is the brain makes a small amount of FSH each month. As a woman gets older and she has less and less eggs, there's less and less inhibin. Without inhibin, the FSH levels go high. All right? And that's why we can use day 3 as a marker of ovarian reserve, a marker of how many eggs that a woman has left in her ovaries. So what we know is women who have high elevated FSHs, they have a poor response to ovarian stimulation, and they're less likely to conceive with IVF cycles. The issue with FSH is that the sensitivity, its ability to pick up women who are not going to respond well, is not so great. Look at it. It's 10 to 80%. That's a pretty wide range. FSH bounces around each month, and I don't know if you guys see that. You understand, why are the doctors checking this FSH every single month? The patients are sick of it. They don't want to pay for it anymore. Well, it's important to check FSH because it does bounce around, all right? It might be normal, normal again, and then all of a sudden the next month it'll be abnormal. And you go, aha, well, is my chance of getting conceiving, is it as good as my normal FSH, or is my chance of conceiving, is it more analogous to my bad FSH? And these are the things that the patients are going to ask you. And we think that the worst FSH is probably the most predictive of what's going on with a patient. AMH is another hormone that we use to help predict how a woman of advanced maternal age will do with IVF. AMH is produced by the granulosa cells in the follicles themselves. The way I tell my patients about it is that every egg makes a little AMH, so the more eggs you have, the more AMH you have. AMH is different than FSH. FSH is critical because it's actually telling the ovary what to do with the menstrual cycle, so it's going to fluctuate throughout the menstrual cycle. Well, AMH doesn't do that. It's kind of made by the eggs. They make the same amount of AMH all the time, so it's going to be very consistent throughout the menstrual cycle and consistent between menstrual cycles. So you don't need to check an AMH in January, February, March, because it's going to be kind of consistent. It's not going to be the same in January of 2014 as it's going to be in January of 2016. So 2 years down the line, it makes sense to check the AMH. But you don't have to be checking the AMH every month like the FSH. The issue with AMH is that when we see really low levels or almost undetectable levels, although it's very helpful in telling us that this woman may not respond as well to the stimulation, her egg quality might not be as good, and her pregnancy outcomes are not going to be so great, there isn't a threshold at which we tell the patient, you should just not do IVF, because women who have undetectable AMH levels can still get pregnant. So undetectable doesn't mean impossible. So all of these tests, just like with FSH, they're a little bit more helpful for us when they're abnormal. When the tests are all normal, what you have to fall back on is the age of the woman, because the age of the woman is going to be your best predictor in trying to figure out what her ability is to get pregnant and what type of treatment protocols you should be using. Markers of ovarian reserve are also very important for us because they're going to identify those patients who with IVF are going to be poor responders. Once we identify them as women who might be poor responders, we can better adjust, one, what type of treatments we're going to use if you are using IVF, what types of protocols that you're going to choose to best help them make more eggs. Because remember, a lot of this, again, comes down to statistics. We know that women that are older have less normal eggs in their ovaries. So how can we help them get pregnant with IVF? We can get more eggs out so that the chance that we're going to find a normal one is higher. So how do we improve and optimize success in our older patients? And that involves improving that stimulation. And I'm not going to talk a ton about stimulation protocols. You're going to hear a little bit about that later today. But what I would like to just touch upon is that oftentimes with older patients, we're thinking about using stronger, more aggressive protocols. That may involve using increased amount of drugs, using different types of protocols that all work towards the common goal of getting more eggs, again, to increase the chance that we're going to get a normal one out in that group. So remember, with normal ovulation, your brain makes a small amount of FSH. because of that cohort of eggs that you have there in that month, your brain just wants you to ovulate one egg. It doesn't want you to have eight babies, right? It wants you to have one. So it secretes enough FSH so one of that group that are there will grow. With everything that we do, whether it's injectable IUIs or IVF, we're giving more FSH. More FSH, more LH. If you give more gonadotropins, then what happens is more eggs can grow. One of the important things that I think when you're talking to your patients is to really tell them that what we do is we do the best we can with how your ovaries are functioning at this time. It's important to let them know that we can't reverse aging. So I can't make someone who's 40, who has an antral follicle count of 4, I can't make 20 eggs appear. But what we can best do is make sure that the 4 eggs that she has all grow so that we can get them all out in an IVF cycle. So one of the ways of doing that is, in addition to just giving the gonadotropins, giving FSH and LH through the shots, is actually improving the amount of endogenous FSH and LH that the patient's own pituitary is secreting. One of the ways to do that is with a protocol called microdose flare. You guys are probably familiar with it. And what I just want to review with you is, what is the microdose Lupron doing? Right? What the GnRH is doing is that when we give to the patient, for the first few days, it's causing a huge endogenous surge of both FSH and LH. And then on top of that, we're layering on the gonadotropins. We did a study of patients where we actually just gave them microdose Lupron and didn't give them gonadotropins at all. And this is what we found when we looked at the FSH levels and LH levels. So you can see the patient's own FSH levels and LH levels, they increase over the first few days, but by about the 5th or 7th day, those levels have plummeted. And this is where the Lupron is kind of magical, because it does two things in one cycle. It causes the own endogenous FSH and LH to go up in the beginning, but by the end of the cycle, it prevents the patient from ovulating. Another protocol that we often use with women with advanced maternal age is giving them the antagonist protocol, where they come in on day 2 of their period, we kind of blast them right away with a lot of drugs to try to really get as many eggs as possible in that cohort to grow. Again, you do have to prevent them from ovulating, so with this type of cycle, you start them on gonadotropins early and add the antagonist right before you get them ready for the egg retrieval. One thing that you can add to the antagonist protocol that will improve their own, again, increase and improve their own endogenous FSH and LH is Clomid. Remember, Clomid is an estrogen receptor antagonist. It binds to the estrogen receptors and tricks the brain into thinking that estrogen levels are really low. And so the brain compensates by secreting a ton of FSH and LH. So if you add clomiphene to an antagonist cycle, it's kind of a little bit like the microdose flare. But for some women, the birth control pills that you often will use with a microdose flare are just kind of too suppressive. So sometimes this is a very good protocol for those patients where even the microdose flare is a little bit too suppressive. One thing that you can add to this type of protocol is estrogen priming. Estrogen priming works really well for your patients that are older that show up on day 2 and they already have a follicle that's 14 millimeters. So if you have a 14-millimeter follicle, it's already making estrogen, what's going to happen if you give them a bunch of gonadotropins? It's all going to go to that 14-millimeter follicle, right? That 14-millimeter follicle has just become a 19-millimeter follicle, and all the rest of them, they're gone. They're not growing. They've already started going through apoptosis, and they've started to resorb. So for those women, what's happening is that that urge of the brain to secrete FSH is so high that it's happening in the menstrual cycle ahead of time. And so by the time they come in on day 2 of their period, they already have that dominant follicle, and there's nothing we can do to reverse that process. So one thing that we can do is actually prevent it. If you give them estrogen, remember when we talked about the ovary making estrogen inhibin, those are things that decrease the FSH? Well, the same concept applies if you actually give them exogenous estrogen in the cycle before. So they ovulate about a week later. People do patches or oral esterase. You give them estrogen, and it suppresses the woman's endogenous FSH. So if she's one of those people who always shows up with a dominant follicle on day 2, she has a better chance of not having had that selection process happen on day 2, so that when you give her gonadotropins, instead of just getting one egg to grow, you might get 3 or 4. So what are options for older women when IVF stops working? And the answer is egg donation. So the first egg donation pregnancy was in 1983. The donor was actually 42 years old. She made 5 eggs. She kept 4 for herself and unfortunately didn't get pregnant, but the one egg that she gave to the other recipient, who was 38, that woman got pregnant. So it just goes to show you just need one good egg. Unfortunately, this egg wasn't good enough, and this woman did eventually miscarry. So the first live birth was done a year later in 1984, and this was a 29-year-old who had blocked tubes. She, again, actually only had 5 eggs, kept 4 and donated 1, and the recipient, who had premature ovarian failure, who was in her 20s, got pregnant and delivered a baby. Egg donation is interesting, and if you work with egg donation, it can be very complicated, just like this slide. This slide looks really complicated, right? Well, this is what egg donation is, really complicated for the nurses, because you guys have to coordinate these cycles and synchronize the donor who's going through. She's taking her gonadotropins, and maybe she's on Lupron, or she's doing the antagonist. Well, at the same time, what we're focusing on with the recipient is making sure that their uterus is okay. So we're giving them estrogen over the course of about 2 weeks. We give them increasing doses of estrogen to mimic what's happening in a natural cycle. You layer on the progesterone. The progesterone changes the uterine environment so that an embryo can implant. But you have to synchronize everything. One of the things that we take for granted when we think about egg donation is that it works, right? I mean, it's obvious to everyone in this room. Everyone knows about egg donation. It works, right? Well, that wasn't obvious back in the 1980s. Why should egg donation work? That eggs age, the ovaries age. Why shouldn't the uterus age? So we didn't know that what we know now, which is, in fact, if you can give your patient estrogen, progesterone, you time everything the right way, you can make almost any uterus hold a pregnancy. That was a pretty novel concept in the 80s and the early 90s. So, in fact, Rick Paulson, who has come here and lectured from USC, he's actually one of the physicians who was the first people to publish on egg donation. And this is from their study in the early 1990s. And what they saw with this study is that women who are under 40 with egg donation, their pregnancy rates were really good. And pregnancy rates of 33%, 30% was really good back in the 1990s. What they saw in women who are over 40 is that the pregnancy rates remained the same. And that was the first time that anyone had actually showed this. And they compared it to women who are going through IVF on their own in their 40s, where the pregnancy rates were pretty poor. This slide here shows cumulative pregnancy rates. This is, again, in the 1990s, so the pregnancy rates were a little bit lower, but cumulative pregnancy rates with egg donation showing that eventually most patients will get pregnant with egg donation. What's interesting, I think, again, two things to point out. If you look at the first cycle, not everyone gets pregnant. So, again, setting your expectations for your patients going through egg donation that they may not get pregnant that first time. They have a very good likelihood, but they may not. And the reason is if you go back in maybe in your binders or just think about that chart that we were looking at, the blastocysts that were being checked for chromosomal abnormalities, well, even in donors, they were only normal about 65% of the time. So even with egg donors, you're going to have abnormal embryos, so your patients are not going to get pregnant the first time every time. What I think is really interesting is if you look at this graph and then you start superimposing different ages of the recipients, which you see here, the line stays the same. So it doesn't really matter if the uterus is in its 30s, 40s, or even 50s. The pregnancy rates and the cumulative pregnancy rates stay the same because the uterus doesn't age all that much. And it doesn't matter why the woman is having to do egg donation. Did she go through natural menopause? Did she go through menopause at a normal time in her 50s or really early in her 30s? Does she have menopause because she went through chemotherapy? It doesn't matter. Pregnancy rates are the same. Even when you look at the age of the male partner, a little bit what we talked about in the last lecture, again, it doesn't have that much of an impact on pregnancy rates with egg donation. This is actually looking, again, at the CDC pregnancy rates with IVF. As you can see, as a woman gets older, like we talked about before, her chance of getting pregnant goes down. With egg donation, no matter what her age is, even when she's climbing into her late 40s, pregnancy rate stays the same. Because of this, The majority of cycles that we're seeing in this country that are being done for women in their late 40s are actually egg donation cycles, and you can see that in this graph. And in fact, by 2010, 12% of ART cycles were all egg donor cycles. So what happens to the uterus after 50? This was one of the things that was being pondered at our institution. It's kind of clear there was a lot of people doing egg donation for women in their 40s, but what happens to women in their 50s? Do you still see the same pregnancy rates? Is the uterus still working in the 50s? And what we were able to show is that in a publication of 14 couples, is that pregnancy rates and live birth rates were 38% and 33%. When we compared that to what our pregnancy rates were in the patients going through egg donation in their 40s at the same time, because remember, this is in the 1990s when pregnancy rates were a little bit lower, they're very similar. So again, even women in their 50s were able to get pregnant with egg donation. But is there something else besides just the age of the uterus that's important to consider when you're trying to get someone pregnant who's in her 50s? Are there other things to consider besides the embryo's ability to implant in the uterus? Do you need to think about other pregnancy complications that are a danger to the mother? What about life expectancy of to the parents? What about the quality of the life that they can provide for the children? And these are things that we were pondering as we were doing more and more egg donation. So we did a retrospective analysis of 77 women who are postmenopausal over the age of 50, over a decade, and wanted to look at what obstetrical outcomes were. So the mean age of these patients was 52. All of the women that were in their 50s going through egg donation went through the same screening that our younger women who were recipients went through. They went through general health screening. In addition to that, we made all of our women go through testing of their cardiovascular reserve with either EKGs or a stress test. But they had the same routine testing looking at the uterus. They went through a mock cycle. They went through psychosocial counseling, which we recommend for all of our patients going through egg donation, and preconception counseling. In these women, we had 89 egg retrievals and had a 45% pregnancy rate. What we found is the women that delivered had very high C-section rates. So the overall C-section rate was 78%. Even in singletons, it was 68%, and multiples, not surprisingly, it was 100%. When you look at the rate of gestational diabetes, one of the most common complications in pregnancy, diabetes happened in 20% of women. That's really high. That compares to about 5% in overall. You know, gestational diabetes does happen more commonly when women are older. It's a little bit higher, closer to 10% in women over 30. We know with IVF, it's closer to 10%. But 20% is still double that number. When you look at preeclampsia, pregnancy-induced hypertension, another very common complication in pregnancy, that happened in 35% of our women, so a third of the women had PIH. This compares to about 5% in young women, 10% in women over 40, and 10% in what we see with most IVF cycles. So what we know is that women who are in their 50s have 2 times the rate of diabetes, 3 times the rate of PIH, and very high operative delivery rates. Is there a cut point, though, in the 50s that makes a big difference? Is it the extremes of age, the women that are in their older 50s? Is it all women in their 50s? That was one thing that we wanted to look at. And when we actually broke down the data, what we were able to find is that the age of 55 seems to be a limiting factor, where above the age of 55, we see really high rates of both preeclampsia and diabetes. Look at 60, 40%. That's really high. So is 55 a physiologic limit? The uterus can hold the pregnancy, the embryo can implant, but are there other issues that you need to consider? And so for us at our institution, all of our recipients of egg donation need to be 53 when they get pregnant and 54 by the time they deliver. And we don't like to do egg donation above those ages because of the complications that we see in pregnancy. One of the other things that we were interested in was looking at how these people parent. What is their life like as parents when they have kids in their 50s? So we wanted to look at both parenting stress and physical functioning. So we did a study of women, again, going through egg donation in their 50s and compared them to women who went through IBS in their 30s and 40s. And they all got a parenting stress index and a health profile that evaluated their quality of life. And what we were able to see is that women in their 50s had very similar physical functioning to the women in their 30s and 40s, and actually higher than the national average. Again, looking at mental functioning, we didn't see any decline in women in their 50s, and again, higher than the national average. What I think is most fascinating about the study is actually looking at parenting stress, and what we found is that women in their 50s actually had decreased parenting stress compared to women in their 30s and 40s. Probably some of this is self-selected, because obviously if you're in your 50s, you have to feel really good about your ability to parent, and probably have been through a lot in life, and things like a two-year-old don't stress you out so much. So what we found from this study is that our women in the 50s, they didn't really differ either physically or mentally from the younger women, and they certainly didn't seem to suffer from a greater amount of stress than the women in their 30s and 40s. So is it that when you're in your 50s, you can, because of your life experiences, you're better able to adapt to parenting? And certainly, I think what this shows us is there really isn't any physical or mental capacity of these patients that really should be an impediment to them for actually having children. So I think it's one of those things where we're seeing more and more women in their early 50s having children, that as a society, our perception of aging and our expectation of aging and reproduction may change. So what have we learned today about advanced maternal age and the biological clock? Well, we've learned that it's been ticking since before we were born as women. We've learned that the biological clock is ticking because as women, you lose both the quantity and quality of your eggs. We also know that you can potentially pause the biological clock by going through fertility preservation and freezing eggs of our young patients. If you haven't done that, you have a possibility of beating the biological clock by identifying those women who have poor ovarian reserve and improving their odds of getting pregnant by adjusting the amount of medication they're on and the stimulation protocols that they're on. And if the clock has already beat you, we can fool it and we can circumvent it by doing egg donation. So I'd like to conclude. Thank you very much for your attention. I'd be happy to answer all the questions that you have.
I think people are having trouble hearing answers, so we'll each take a mic so that they can hear better.
Sure.
Is AMH more accurate day 2, 3, or 4 than later in the cycle? Our physicians ask our patients to have 2 AMHs. What's your opinion?
So that's actually 2 different questions, and I'll answer both of them. So the AMH doesn't bounce around in the menstrual cycle, so it doesn't matter when you get it. The one time that we do actually see a change in AMH is if someone's on birth control pills. I mean, the studies are mixed on that. I think there are some studies that show that if you're on birth control pills, the AMH is not impacted. There are some studies that show that the AMH is actually decreased if they're on pills. And I think that that's important when you're evaluating an egg donor or someone who is interested in fertility preservation. In my experience, I definitely have seen the AMH sometimes, for some patients, definitely lower on birth control pills. You get them off of birth control pills. 2 months later, their AMH is higher, and sometimes even their antral follicle count is higher. The second question was also about AMH.
Like
I was having
two.
And I think that can be important. I think that if the AMH assay is new, it's going through some changes. We've had multiple assays in the last 10 years, and so the normal ranges have been adjusted somewhat. And so, like any assay, it's not perfect. And so if you are changing what you do based on your AMH and the difference, remember the range of values with AMH is really low. So AMH above 2 is normal, and below 2 is what we consider abnormal, and below 1 is where we really start to see changes in, I think, how a patient responds to medication. And if you're making adjustments in your protocol and how you treat people based on an AMH of 1.1 versus 1.4, it might be a good idea to maybe get 2 of them just to make sure you're getting an accurate assessment. The other thing is if you get an AMH and it just really doesn't correlate with the FSH or the antral follicle count, you may want to repeat it and just make sure that it's not off due to assay variation.
Next question. Can you talk about human growth hormone and CoQ to help with egg quality?
Yeah, I think there's a lot of data out there, both with growth hormone and CoQ, which is an antioxidant supposed to alleviate reactive oxygen species. I think that the data out there is somewhat mixed. I think some people are big proponents of both growth hormone and treating their patients with antioxidants, both to improve egg quality. But I don't think the data is extremely strong. So I think there are some people that just choose not to use those.
If a woman wants to do elective fertility preservation, not for cancer, but for preservation, what age might you prefer to see them freeze their eggs? Since you guys are liberal with your donor cycle, what would you do for that?
I think that there's two parts to that. I think part of that is how young is too young. If you have someone come into you and she's 22, is that really too young and you shouldn't be doing it? I think that I think it's reasonable to wait to a point where a woman's fertility starts declining. So you're not going to see that much difference between 22 and 27. So there isn't a huge impetus for a woman to do egg freezing at 22. You might as well give herself a couple more years until maybe she's more well-established and maybe has met someone that she's ready to have a family with. But there's a big difference between 30 and 38. And so I think getting someone in before they're 35 and we start seeing these greater declines in fertility is probably an optimal time. We have patients that come to us that are 42 and want to freeze eggs. And the problem with that is that women who are 42, they have less eggs. So you put them through a cycle, you're not going to get that many eggs. And the eggs that they have, the chance that every egg that is could become a pregnancy of those that we freeze is so low that the benefit that you're going to get out of an egg freezing cycle when someone is older is much less. I mean, there's no difference between the impact of age on the eggs, whether you're freezing them or having them go through an IVF cycle. And so that's something that you have to keep in mind when you're counseling the patients.
Are you noticing more younger patients in your practice? We're seeing late 20s and early 30s more recently. Are you seeing like a shift towards seeing younger people coming in for treatment?
Is that what you're with egg freezing or?
It wasn't
I don't know.
It doesn't.
Sorry. My assumption is that it's probably egg freezing versus just actually IVF treatments. We tend to see a lot of older patients in our IVF practice, fertility practice. But I would say I think I have seen a huge shift in the age of patients that are coming to me interested in egg freezing. I think a lot of that was the ASRM lifting the experimental label on egg freezing. And after that happened, I think there was a lot of buzz in the media, and it's becoming more common. I think you hear about egg freezing on, Keeping Up with the Kardashians. And so everyone's hearing about egg freezing now. And so whereas 5 years ago, the patients that were coming to me interested in egg freezing were in their late 30s, 38, 39, 40. The majority of my patients are usually in their 30s, somewhere between 30 and 35 that are coming in now.
We only have time for one more.
Sure.
I think this is confusing to nurses when you have a patient with an AMH in January 2014 of 2.18 and then in June of 2014, 0.35, same lab, no meds, no changes.
Yeah, that's the problem with the assay variation. And I think that as the assay for AMH continues to be worked on and perfected, we're going to see less of that variation. And that's sometimes why getting two AMHs can be helpful if you're really getting someone who has an AMH of 0.35, but they have an antral follicle count of 20 and they're 30, you have to say, okay, so maybe something's wrong and maybe the assay is just off. There is an ultra-sensitive AMH assay that's going to be coming on the market too, and that's going to confuse things even more.
Will the range change?
I think the ultra-sensitive AMH is only good at the very, very low values. So I think that that might be more helpful for the women who have advanced maternal age and have poor ovarian reserve. But it's not going to be helpful for someone who has an AMH of 6.
Thank you very much.
You're welcome.